Welcome to The Created Life. Each week, The Created Life podcast offers insightful, inspiring interviews with entrepreneurs, creatives, and people just like you about being empowered, living with vitality, and creating positive change in the world through creative action. The Created Life covers a wide range of topics relating to personal growth, adventure, inspiration, business, social impact, fitness, and health. My name is Damian Taggart. I'm a serial social impact entrepreneur, and I'll be your host on this journey. Thanks for joining me for this episode of The Created Life. On today's podcast, I have the privilege of interviewing an incredibly talented and kind man who has dedicated the past 30 years of his life to creating a safe haven for youth in Española through arts education. Roger Montoya is co-founder and artistic director for Moving Arts, a nonprofit dedicated to uplifting the lives of youth in a community that has endured generational poverty, addiction, and familial violence. Since his diagnosis with HIV in the late 1980s, Roger has spent his life pursuing meaningful impact through the arts. This is a really great conversation with a wonderful human being that I am truly inspired by. Please give it a listen. You can support the work of The Created Life by telling your friends about the podcast and sharing this episode. I hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to this week's episode of The Created Life. I'm here with Roger Montoya, who is co-founder of Moving Arts in Española, New Mexico. Thanks so much for being here with me, Roger. It's a pleasure to see your space and to kind of get to know what you're up to.
It's great to meet you, and thank you so much for having me.
Cool. Do you want to give our listeners just an overview of kind of what Moving Arts is about and kind of what you guys are, what kind of thing you've created here?
Yes, Moving Arts is a safe haven for youth and families, really sort of a community center based in arts, expression, unity, safety. It's a really cool space. We basically took over a very large former casino building and we turned it into a multi-arts space with after-school tutoring, free meal program, opportunities for kids of all ages, really. We have a lot of youth mentors that are on staff from age 14 to 22, staff of 15 professional artists in various mediums from dance, music, and drama, and acrobatics, circus arts, culinary arts. It's kind of a really a full-service venue, if you will, for families.
Yeah, wow. I love the fact that it's sort of combined so many different elements, and it's like really kind of remarkable. Like, it's just this this haven for creativity and for kind of all things life affirming, it seems. So you've got, you know, everything from the physicality of like acrobatics to, you know, just standard creativity through like painting and other kinds of you know, audio and visual expression, and then one of the things that's really interesting and kind of unique too is that you add in these elements of nutrition and how to take care of yourself. And so it's like, really, you know, it seems like you're covering every base in terms of, you know, creating a vital community, creating vitality in a community. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you kind of got to this?
Yeah, it's a model based in mind, body, and spirit, you know, kind of the whole big picture of focusing on children who are suffering from adverse childhood experiences, because a lot of the population we have in the world in general, but certainly in Española, are really suffering with a background of poverty, violence, drug addiction, cyclical familial trauma, historic trauma. And so sounds kind of a downer, but the beautiful thing is that when youth and families come into this space, ultimately they find a voice. They find a place to live, a place to sort of feel comfortable. And then I feel that that's the opening for a whole bunch of other great stuff that's kind of unintended, you know, because once someone feels safe and they have an expression, an outlet, then therapeutic modalities or, you know, pathways are discovered. You know, it just kind of is an opening. And we kind of go from there. So it's kind of an interesting vessel or a space that we have created that it has a lot of fluidity.
That's really great. So how long have you been operating here?
We have been at this site for about 6 years. We are a nonprofit organization, 11 years in existence. I've been doing this kind of work for about 30 years in northern New Mexico here, primarily in the city of Española, this region really.
So when you talk about that cyclical, you know, kind of cycle of trauma, of like whether it's drug addiction or poverty or family violence or other things like gang violence or something like that, when you think about the work that you've done for the last 30 years, have you seen, or do you feel like this work, have you seen it translate into a larger healing in the community? And can you talk about that a little bit? How you've seen the impacts of it?
I think most evidence that we have is in our youth who have grown up. You know, kids that I started with in 91, 92, 93 are now in their mid-30s and early 40s, and their kids are in the program. And there's a marked change. You know, those that early wave got one thing, and then as we graduated over the decades now, there's been layer upon layer. But most recently, in the last 10 years, we had a wave of graduates last year, about 15 youth, key youth, that kind of all graduated high school and went on to college. And that was really the epiphany for us. It's like, wow, we've really made a difference, because these kids wrote in their scholarship essays, or they wrote us letters back from their first weeks of college, you know, just profound, beautiful statements about where they are as humans. They have a clear path. They have a vision for their lives, and one day to return back to this beautiful valley to contribute again. And we're starting to see that happening. It takes a while.
Totally.
To develop a child from 2 years old, say, up to a place where they're really vibrating and thinking of totally. Critically about their future.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's something that I've thought a lot about, you know. And, you know, I used to live in Albuquerque. I lived there for maybe 8 years off and on. And that's another community that really struggles with a lot of these problems. There are communities within Albuquerque that really struggle with crime and drug use and I think cyclical effects of poverty and it's like, you know, people are being raised in kind of suboptimal conditions, and then that's all they know, and they don't really see it does create this sort of negative feedback loop. And I think about, you know, I'd be interested to hear, you guys have done a great job here in Española, like trying to provide an alternative, trying to inspire a different kind of future for people, even if they come from, you know, families where situations aren't great or something like that. Do you have any kind of like words of advice or ideas about how other communities could you know, start to change these kind of unfortunate cycles that they get caught in?
I truly believe that this recipe, this program that we've created, this model is replicable for sure. I think I mentioned last week to somebody, it's about what community doesn't have talented and underserved youth, a community of artists that are willing to contribute and share their love and passion, and then empty buildings that abound. You know, that's really how we started. It's over time has created an economic development component as well. We employ part-time 35 individuals who love being here and are greatly fed as they're feeding children and young people. So it's a beautiful sort of microcosm of goodness. We use the arts as medicine, in a sense. And people say, well, what do you mean by medicine? And it's hard to quantify or define or explain. But when the point of expression or that connectivity to the medium, be it drama, be it culinary, be it paint, be it music, a violin, a guitar, or dance, there's something that takes over the being and allows them to feel comfortable in their own skin. and therefore be able to identify and connect with trauma or other gifts or a whole array of things that we don't normally access in our normal lives because they're so external. The arts is very internal, and it gives self-knowledge, a sense of identity, and then, of course, that purpose that can be built on. It does take time, and the magic potion, the key ingredient, is the mentorship. You have to have role models that can be 5 years older. So in the case of a six-year-old, even an 11-year-old can make a marked difference if that kid has a focus. But if you're talking seasoned professional artists mentoring teenagers who are mentoring six-year-olds, that's a gorgeous recipe, really, for what we're
That's really awesome
talking about.
I love that. Yeah, and it's another thing I've been thinking about with some of the other projects I'm working on. Like, I really like the idea of bringing together different age groups and cohorts, because I think so much of the time it's like, as a teenager, you only hang out with the teenagers, or as a 20-something, you're only hanging out with 20-somethings. And, you know, recently I've been lucky enough to make friends with people who are in their 70s and 80s, and realizing, like, wow, these people have, like, a really, you know, a depth of experience and knowledge, but they're just human beings and they're interesting people. And it's like, I don't have to put some weird, like, oh, these are old people. Or in the same thing, I've got two young boys, and it's like, I'm constantly learning from my six-year-old and his friends. And, you know, it's like, so I think the more we can find ways to bring people together and to kind of create unity, that's like a heavy, you know, heavily on my mind of just like, how can we build unity and come from a place of understanding how much we're the same. And then once we have that as a foundation, we can start to really celebrate our differences as well. So it's not like we have to all be the same and there's no diversity, but it's like, at first we're humans, and then we have all these other, like, really interesting ways that we diverge. Do you guys think about unity as part of the work that you're doing here?
We don't think about it directly. It's just kind of innate to how we move in the world. It's an open vessel, and people feel comfortable from all walks of life. Young, old, Sikh community, Mexicano, the natives, Indo-Hispano, everybody feels that they have a place here. And so they come together, and then the real magic happens when performances or public celebrations happen, where we see it in action. And we're all celebrating the same thing. That's, I think, when the magic happens, and you see people really find understanding cross-culturally, and this acceptance that we are one. It sounds a little corny, but when you see it in action, it's quite incredible.
Totally. That's great. Yeah. You had said something to me about... you had some interesting phrases in when we were emailing back and forth. You said something about how communities can choose a collective impact model that embraces adversity through creativity and transform their lives and the health and wellness of the world. Do you want to expand on some of those ideas a little bit? Talk about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, one case in point is Rio Arriba is 5 times the national average for deaths due to opioid use in the nation. 5 times. Some people might look at that and go, holy cow, how do you even begin to address that? But we have all the pieces across this beautiful landscape. Practitioners, governments who care, individuals, families, youth who can speak out and take a stand. And so if we can create a really beautiful plan that's multi-layered, sustainable, and has outcomes that are positive, taking this sort of a bed of trauma and violence and just really terror, and turning it into something that is active, that is looking at the positive aspects of, you know, we're, some of us are still living. How can we do early intervention? How can we go back to prenatal even and really think about, okay, if we're going to really make a change, how can we work as a team? So what's beautiful about Rio Arriba County and Española is that, you know, from the county, from the Health and Human Services, from nonprofits, the Northern New Mexico College is putting together an ACEs Institute, which is Adverse Childhood Experiences Institute, to study and really map assets and look at gaps as a team? How do we engage youth? How do we find ways to really celebrate the adversity so we can get to the place where we can move the needle? Rather than, oh my God, you know, we're just going to do this in prison pipeline and everybody's, you know, pump more into late stage recovery and addiction. Yes, we have that problem, but we also have a community at all levels that have not entered into addiction or misuse of substances. And so there's a lot we can do. And it's a remarkable team here. I mean, it's world class.
That's amazing.
People don't realize how powerful our team is.
That's really great.
So that's one example.
Do you, so you had mentioned something about thinking this model is replicable. Do you guys have any plans to replicate what you're doing in other communities or to like help other people incubate a similar space or something like that?
Well, the recent film that Meow Wolf put out called Community Voices was remarkable in so many ways because A, we got to see kind of a mirror was held up in a way because we're in the ditch digging. We're every day. We're just going years past. And it was so remarkable, A, to see it, what we've created through the lens of the filmmaker, Jody McNicholas, who has become a great friend. But to your point of can it be replicated, different folks have contacted us now because they're seeing and hearing and reading and understanding more intimately what we do. So there's been a call to sort of say, hey, you know, we have a community here. What about this? Would you help us?
Right.
So that's happened.
Cool.
Internally in the city, we have found another campus that we're working with the county and the city to perhaps develop a similar moving arts model, but for a little bit older population, like 16 to 36 with a big multi or intergenerational component. That's looking not only at arts, but at workforce development, sort of social services for teens that are homeless, folks that are disenfranchised and can't find that on-ramp into the Northern New Mexico College or vocations. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an interesting incubator model that we're looking at, and it's a beautiful old campus in the heart of Española. So that's one way that we're thinking in the region to create another similar model. Based on this nexus of creativity and opportunity in one building.
Very cool. Is there anything else that you wanted to kind of add to, you know, that we haven't covered sort of about what Moving Arts is or what Moving Arts is up to? Because I want to kind of shift gears and talk more about, learn more about you and your life and sort of how you got to the point of even starting Moving Arts. But before we shift, is there anything else that you wanted to just kind of add to what we've been saying?
The notion of, I said it in the film, that probably our most important component is the youth leadership development component, because when a kid comes at, say, 3, 4, 5 years old and they stay for 10 years, they are equipped, they're tooled, they're sort of fueled with this passion, and there's about 10 of them right now that are just blowing me away. Mm. In fact, this afternoon at 3:30, we're meeting with the mayor of the city. He has a call to action to end violence. And 10 of 50 youth have engaged. These high school kids are from Moving Arts. And they're taking leadership roles. They're writing their scripts. They're planning. They're creating this whole facilitation plan. And I'm standing back from it and just not doing a whole heck of a lot because the kids are taking the reins. And these are, you know, these are, one of them is 22, the rest are between like 17 to 22 years old. Mm-hmm. And so we've created, without even really thinking strategically about that outcome, a team that's equipped, capacitized. It's blowing my mind.
That's really cool.
Loving it.
Can you talk, expand on that a little bit and tell me what leadership means to you?
I think first and foremost, one has to understand who they are. Uniquely and confidently and with bold expression. Because if we understand that our fingerprint is absolutely unique, there's not another person on the planet that has what you bring. The arts, as I said, as medicine, is a way that people can identify that and then develop it. So I think key is identity. And then next is sort of a vision. You know, and artists, because we're working with media all the time, how are you going to express this choreography, or how are you going to do that piece or that recipe? And I think those are really transferable skills when you mm-hmm. start to think about the broader world, mm-hmm. the community, and what impact you can have as a leader. And then the capacity to communicate that, you know, and the arts, again, is a perfect way, because you trust that your identity and your voice is clear and radiant and right on without being arrogant.
Right.
Humility is absolutely a foundational base that artists have to hold, but they can be righteous and they can understand that they have a clear vision to execute.
Totally. On that note, it just also makes me think about, I'd be curious to hear you talk about just your, what creativity means to you in general, because that's something that I thought a lot about. And I think that a lot of times we think about creativity pretty much just in the realm of the artist or somebody who's creating, like, you know, a playwright or something like that.
Right.
I like to think of it as a broader thing that kind of is a, whether you're like a plumber or a doctor or anything, that like you're still making choices and you're still, you know, every time you choose one thing over another, you're kind of creating something. You know,
it's a creative decision.
And so that's like kind of where I come from when thinking about it. I'm also like, you know, come from sort of an arts background myself, but my vision of what it means to be an artist is definitely expanded. And I'd like to hear kind of what's your sense of creativity? What does it mean to you?
Well, my life, I started doing drawing very early, and then I moved quickly into gymnastics and tumbling. That I was a competitive gymnast for about 10 years. And then I moved into about 10 years, 15 years of dance training in New York City. And then I returned to New Mexico and became a visual artist. So I've had this sort of wide landscape of experiences about creating, not only with my body, but on stage, and interpreting music and movement and paint, ultimately. And so I use metaphorically all of those experiences as I approach community. I see the people, the players, the obstacles that people can perceive as obstacles as paint, or people that were moving in fluid, in tandem, and creating rhythm and pulse and intention, so that everything we do is a banquet of beauty and celebration, and people are inspired and drawn like moths to a flame of the excitement and the creative impulse of what's happening. Even if it's a health fair or a public meeting, it still should have a beauty to it and almost a ceremony,
right?
If you will.
A vibrance.
Yeah,
or
it's like,
yeah,
if you're making a beautiful meal, it should be absolutely gorgeous. The senses should be awakened, the timing, you know. So again, metaphorically speaking, all of my experiences from making acrobatic flips to being on stage or making choreography or painting a painting, they all apply in how I address adversity. And most importantly, creativity, and how we're gonna pull the community together and inspire them.
That's awesome. So it sounds like a big part of that is like being, having to be present in the moment. Like even if you know you're in some meeting or something like that, it's like realizing that it doesn't matter what this context is, we're still like living out our lives, and we're still like, if you can bring yourself to that, like to me, it sounds like there's a lot of like, you probably have a pretty deep sense of gratitude. It sounds like that's probably a big part of the way you see the world. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Definitely. I'm in gratitude each day. In 1986, I tested positive as an HIV positive man. And this is right in the middle of the decade when people were beginning to drop like flies.
Mm.
As we know, the AIDS pandemic from 1980 to 1990 was devastating. And I was at ground zero. I was living in Los Angeles, and then I moved to New York City right after 1986.
So you're like in the center of the epidemic.
I was in the epicenter and lost hundreds of dear, dear, talented young friends. And so having come through that line of fire, and you know, the years passed, and so I was like, oh my God, I'm not going to die.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I have an opportunity. There's an urgency to move each day.
Mm.
And to use every piece of material and resource around me to create that painting.
Mm-hmm.
So gratitude, the sense that I need to be scrappy. You know, artists are scrappy. We can make something out of nothing. And I approach that work in community. So I'm absolutely in gratitude and in love and in awe of what's possible, the art of the possible.
So given that, that you kind of survived the AIDS epidemic in the 80s, like, did that give you a sense that, did you feel in a way that you were kind of like, all of this was like a second chance in a way, or like everything that you've had in the last 30 years was like an opportunity that, did it bring that more into that kind of focus for you?
It did, sort of a heightened awareness of being awake,
mm-hmm.
you know, almost like, wow, you know, maybe I got a year. Let's see what we can do in a year.
Right.
You know, let's really think about not just leisurely hanging out and thinking, well, life just goes on.
It's right. Like
this critical and really constant awareness of the preciousness of each second
right.
of the day, not just a year or a week. But like, we got to move now. We got to plant those seeds today.
Totally.
And it's neat.
Yeah, what's interesting is that like everyone, you know, everyone will die. And so we know the answer. We know how it ends, basically. We know what the conclusion of life is. We don't know when or exactly how. But it's interesting how it sometimes takes a near-death experience or a diagnosis of some kind to really like send that to really appreciate that message fully. Because I think like so many of us can get stuck in a sense of like life's gonna go on forever and I have all the time in the world and so then it's like, you know, it takes that like it almost like steals the excitement of no, this is my life, you know, and like being really like aware of the fact that we don't know when we're gonna die, regardless of whether we've had a diagnosis or not. It's like tomorrow could be the last day. And it doesn't mean for me, I think, you know, people can sometimes say like, well, that's too much. I don't want to think about death every day. And it's not so much like dwelling on death, but I feel like understanding that death is, you know, part of all of our story and being real with the fact that this isn't forever, it really just helps to put value on what we have. And so I think that's something that like is, you know, something that I hope to help people discover, like this value. There's almost like a medicine to understanding death and understanding the shortness of life. And it's also long, so you have to make long-term plans too. It's not like being reckless, but...
Right, right. It's been quite interesting. Something else that's been really a learning ground for me was watching the gay community respond, you know, from early 80s all the way through to now. We set the way and we galvanized and then we reached out and helped other groups that were starting to face the same issue. And it was very humble to be part of that because it was not easy. You know, we were all just feeling like this was it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody gives a about us.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to care for each other? And then as the years and decades rolled on, we became more humble and set a model for how people could pull together under adversity. So I learned a lot there as well.
Very, that's very beautiful. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So prior to going to New York to study dance and like in your earlier life growing up, were there any like really significant challenges that you had to overcome like as a younger person, like before or what was your earlier life like?
I was very, very shy, painfully shy, and I had a background of sexual abuse starting very early, and it went on for about 15 years, and it crippled me.
Mm-hmm.
At junior high level, I was, you know, at 13, I was suicidal. I was really, it's interesting because I was a gymnast, and I was very good at in early high school and through high school and into college. I somehow maintained grades and I maintained my athletic accomplishments, but I was dying inside and really crippled with this sense of identity. Like, who am I? Is it okay as a gay Catholic young man, you know, to disappoint my family? I mean, that was just devastating for many, many, many years. And I think it was through the arts, through transitioning to from a collegiate gymnast to a professional dancer, that I finally came to terms. Coincidentally, it was the decade from 80 to 90 that the AIDS epidemic. So it was a double-edged sword, and mm-hmm. it was rich, and it was fast-paced, and it was incredibly inspiring to live in New York City during those years.
So you got your diagnosis in 86, and then you came back to New Mexico in
1989?
89, 90. Cool. And basically, how long was it between coming back here? Because you basically thought you were going to die at that point. And so how long, or you're kind of, can you walk me through like how that transitioned into doing all this work with schools and creating this program? Like, what was that kind of transition phase for you?
Yeah. At that point, I had returned. I was still healthy, even though emotionally I was traumatized by what was happening. And my T cell levels had dropped to a critical low, and they've never really rebounded in 30 years. I've somehow miraculously stayed alive. I have very little immune system. But I just said, well, it's good this week. Mm-hmm. A month went by, 2 months. I started painting because that was really a beautiful thing. I had developed an art interest all my life, self-taught, and I had always sold my work. So here I was in New Mexico, didn't really have a job. So I started working with paint. About a year went by and I said, I've got to make some money. What can I do? I had a gymnastics background and I thought, well, there's a lot of kids. Maybe I can go to the college. So I started a Youth Gymnastics of Northern New Mexico nonprofit. It lasted 5 years. In partnership with the college here in the city. And so that was the first iteration of interfacing with youth and families around wellness. Over that time, we taught 2,000 youth, 5 years. And it was remarkable because I didn't expect it. It was just, well, I'm able to teach a few classes. But I was able to coalesce a really dynamic team and a partnership with an institution that said yes. So that was my first inkling. Well, simultaneously, my art career started to develop. Hmm. And because of my connections in New York City and a foundation that I created called Española Helps, HIV Education, Longevity, Prevention, and Support, it was mostly centered on families that were stigmatized. Hmm. Catholic families where sons were cloistered off and they died of cancer.
Right.
And these mothers were aching, and my mother, being an advocate for public health, she said, let's start a movement. So that lasted 7 years. At the end of the 90s, I transitioned into arts in the schools. I said, let's leave the gymnastics behind. Let's really move into the arts. The thing that really helped me was a notion of visual art and performing arts. Mm-hmm. So I went to my local elementary school and we started a model. We raised about $75,000 with pancake breakfasts and art shows. And I worked very intimately with about 10 artists and 125 students. At the same time, moving into the year 2000, 2001, Max Call, who is now deceased, he was a state rep, Santa Fe County, and he introduced the Fine Arts Education Act funding, which became law in 2002. So I contacted him and we were able to get that funding for our district. So the model I started at a very small rural elementary school became a district-wide model, and I became the natural coordinator. So I worked with 12 principals, 270 teachers, and 75 mm-hmm. teaching artists. We spent $5 million over those 10 years of legislated funding for each school. It was dynamic. And so out of that grew Moving Arts. Mm. The kids wanted more. They wanted an after-school program. We partnered with the Española Public Schools. They gave us free space for about 3 years. And then we became a nonprofit and kind of moved into this realm. So that's kind of the course of how I went from just wanting to do my own creative to let's work with a few kids, to let's join with the public schools. And then suddenly, over the 30 years, it became this unexpected journey of creativity and service to kids and youth.
That's really cool. What advice would you have for somebody who is like, maybe, younger, not necessarily younger, but somebody who wants to do something, has an idea for something, like it's a beginning of a vision for something that they want to do. are there lessons you've learned or any kind of like words of wisdom that you have for somebody who's like maybe on that path of like, I want to jump into the unknown and start, try to start a new program or try to start a new endeavor?
Listen to your heart first. Do you really have it in your soul and passion to make this happen? And then get advice, find a mentor, find another similar program and seek out advice and kind of do some research. You know, what has worked here? What has worked there? Is this applicable in my town or city? And then just get to work, because that recipe of empty building, community artists, and children in need is universal over the globe. And it's a really wonderful sort of potential for a grass fire, if you will. You can start it so easily. What community doesn't have empty buildings and a school district hurting to try to engage community? So I'm just talking about from the concept of youth-serving arts nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
But if a kid has a vision, for example, we have one amazing young woman. She's 22 now. She's absolutely on fire about composting and recycling. In this region, there is nothing happening in recycling for paper, cardboard, glass. And so she has taken it upon herself to create an enterprise, and I'm supporting her. So that's just one way. She came to me, she said, Roger, you've done so much. I'm humbly asking your help.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hot on that issue. So I said, all right, we're going to sit down. So we've been meeting weekly, and she's made tremendous progress in just 2 weeks.
That's awesome. 2 weeks. Wow.
So that's one example of how I think people should make sure you have the fire, do the research, get a mentor, and then just hit the road. You have nothing to lose.
Totally. What would you say, like, do you have any insecurities currently, or like, what are some of your like biggest fears that you still are dealing with?
Wow, interesting question. As a highly creative person, I start too many projects. I have at least 15 projects right now moving. I don't have a staff. People think I'm nuts. How do you juggle those balls? But to me, I see it as one large art piece, and they're interconnected, and they serve each other, and they inform each other. I think...
That's totally like me. I do the same thing, yeah.
But I can't... It's like an addiction in a sense. Because as a creative person, I drive through the city and I see another idea. Wow, what could happen there? They call this, and one thing ricochets to the other. So I just, it's a constant rifling of opportunity to serve and to make things better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a deeply passionate, perhaps a flaw of mine.
Yeah.
Because it's not sustainable on its own.
Right.
I have to find ways to sort of, I don't know if I answered your question.
Do you find that you have to sometimes like just drop projects, like things don't work? You start things and you just like you're juggling too many balls and you have to drop some of the balls. Like, does that happen?
You know what I found over time? This has been 35, 40 years, that all the projects end up happening in some way. Maybe not right now. The spaghetti's thrown on the wall and 8 strands stick, but 85 fell. But somehow we get to them and suddenly I go, wow, you know, that actually, the food program did connect here at this school, or those homeless teens really found that venue and it took us, you know, 4 years. So I kind of hold them all in prayer and I try to engage and I try to connect the dots, because when you're serving humans in societies in great need, there's a lot of work to do, but again, it's all interconnected. And if we shift the consciousness in our leaders and the participants, the citizens, and mostly the young people who will carry the torch forward, the seeds are worth planting because they will sprout.
Totally.
Absolutely.
So another thing that strikes me about your program is the focus on movement, on physical practices like acrobatics, also the connection to eating right, nutrition. Can you talk to me about the importance or what you see as, well, so let me actually rephrase this. I see like a dilemma in the world around people who are being sort of disconnected from their physical bodies. Like people are sitting around like watching TV. They're just like you know, maybe get stuck in a cycle of eating poorly, feeling kind of low energy, going to a job they maybe don't like, and just having this overall drain of kind of like their well-being. And it seems like you've done a lot of work that's really pointedly in the opposite direction of connecting people back to what does it mean to be well. Can you talk a little bit about that work and specifically like the physicality aspects?
Yeah, well, the training as a gymnast and a dancer certainly gave me a deep connection over those 35 years to our vessel, the human instrument that is God-given, and we have to move through it and with it in order to have maximized health. I think it's part and parcel of why I survived. I was mm-hmm. in very good physical condition for 20 years, top training. So there's a discipline, and there's, again, an understanding, an identity that goes with how you actually know that you're feeling good.
Mm-hmm.
The piece of nutrition has always been super important. Northern New Mexico is a perfect place because this is the breadbasket of our state. This is where most of the food is grown. We have an acequia system and beautiful farming tradition that goes back well beyond 400 years. Our native population and the indigenous way has always held the earth as the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been really easy to build an organic farm-to-table meal program here. We've served 25,000 meals in just 2.5 years, free.
Wow.
To every person that walks in the door. And we've harnessed a mechanism through USDA to fund it. So the body is super important. My background is a dancer and a gymnast. Many of the forms that we teach are physical-based. We have 8 types of dance. We have an acrobatics program per se and circus arts. And the rest are in music and drama, but there's physical theater there. And there's just a lot of activity. And I think farming is another really big component. I founded a charter school of the arts and sciences. It's a Montessori-based. It's right behind us on the Pueblo. And it's based in ag business, knowledge of the earth. So again, I always try to layer in intentionally the knowledge and the connectivity to the soil, the seed, the water, the elements, because that's what makes us up.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this sort of physical wellness is essential for like emotional, spiritual, mental well-being?
Absolutely.
So you see those things as connected or one thing, really?
I see them as one piece, you know, mm-hmm. because if you don't have one, you have to find that balance.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids and families that are coming here, they're shifting their concept of what that means because they're seeing it in real time with their kids. Like, wow, Marcos is really changing. You know, his spirit is brighter. He's bringing home recipes with kale and beans and rice, and we're trying them at home. And there's a really, when you're here during the day, it's remarkable. I was sitting just last night with a father who's probably 75, grandfather, and he said, this is the coolest place because where else can you have this beautiful food, a cup of coffee, watching kids creating, stilt walkers are going by, painters over here, music there. He said, it's exhilarating and it makes me feel alive.
That's amazing. Yeah.
As a 75-year-old grandfather who would normally, you know, take his kid to a basketball, you know, and just go to Walmart or something.
Yeah, right.
But he hangs out here because it has vitality. So to answer your question, I think the pieces of physical, emotional, spiritual,
mm-hmm.
they're all one wheel, if you will. We have to keep it rolling and balanced.
Cool. That's really great. We might have covered some of this already, but how would you say you measure the quality of your life?
Wow. My partner, Salvador, who I founded this with, he said, when we see the kids come to check in each day and they're smiling and they're ready and they're just jumping out of their pants to get into the classes, that's our moniker, or that's a way to sort of measure what we're doing here. And I think that's one clear way, because it's all about youth and families. If the kids are inspired and in a place of vitality, then we know that we're doing our work. And it's immediate. We see it every day. We see at least 150 kids through the building every day, 5 days a week. So it's a constant feeding. Mm-hmm. You know, nonprofit work is not easy, but we're fed in so many beautiful ways.
That's great.
Every day.
Do you have any, any maybe like suggestions or insights that could help somebody maybe out there who's listening, who's stuck in a place in their life where they're maybe depressed, or maybe they're just in a rut of some kind and they don't see, you know, it could be addiction. It could be a job they don't like. It could be just a place where they're not quite sure how to follow that like path of vitality. Like, do you have any advice on how people can start to get out of a rut like that?
Yeah, that's tricky, because depression and personal persecution in some cases, that's a very difficult thing to overcome. It's all about perspective. You know, if you can find a way to seek supports therapeutically through church, faith-based, whatever works, running, physical activity, or just reading, just finding that place where you can make yourself available to something inspirational.
Mm-hmm.
And give a try. Take one small step. You know, start walking. Take a class. Step outside of your comfort zone. Help someone. I found that the best in working with people in addiction who are mired in the most paralyzing way, when they begin to mentor peers, that's a big shift I've seen. That's worked more times than not, where suddenly they go, wow, my life experience, which I thought was crap, is actually useful because someone can relate to my story. And then again, it goes back to that sense of worth, identity, and purpose. It's like even what you thought was the worst possible case and you have nothing to contribute, there's always a way for you to be of service. And I think that's one of the most important things I learned from my parents, is that we have to always continue to reach out and to help create and nurture others, because it's not enough just to hold your family and your picket fence and your three cars and 2.5 kids or whatever. It's about the community. We have to invest and connect.
That's really great. I really appreciate that answer. So a question I've been asking everybody that I'm interviewing is basically, if you had one practice or idea that you could spread virally to all people. So like you could just say, wave of your magic wand, like all people now either do this or have this idea or have this new skill. Like what would that be? What would your viral idea be?
To trust your voice or your fingerprint, that you are unique and you have every right to make it heard, and to not do it is criminal in a sense.
Wow.
Because it's so God-given that if we don't take that fingerprint and the voice and make it happen, we've kind of wasted an opportunity. My dad very crudely would say to us, you guys are sucking air. We have 6 kids in our family. You're on the planet. You've got to make it happen. You've got to do something with every day. Otherwise, why are you breathing the oxygen on the earth? And it was like resonating. It was kind of radical and brutal for him to say that, but he was a military man,
right.
Came through the Korean War, saw famine, saw really tragic, you know, lived through the depression, and he had this like work ethic of like, you know, be humble, but by God, get out there and be creative, do something today, make life matter, and bring me back the evidence. I want to see what you're up to.
That's really
very
great.
Very high bar.
I love that. I'm going to make my kids listen to this. Be like, listen to Roger Montoya, trust your voice, and get up to something. Yeah, I love that.
Create something, you know? It's beautiful. It'll feed you. You'll see the result.
That's great. Well, I really appreciate the work that you've done here. I'm looking forward to learning more about your community and what you're up to. I definitely want to come and just check out some of your programs, maybe bring my kids and see some performances or something. It's definitely inspiring. And I really appreciate you taking the time out to have this conversation with me. Is there anything else that you wanted to kind of add before we wrap up?
I think it's a great opportunity where you're creating this vessel for people to share their creative impulse. It's beautiful. I think it's, I commend you, and I am humbled to be part of it. You know, cool. If I can help anyone in any way, and people can always feel free to contact Moving Arts through our website,
cool.
movingartsespanola.org. Track us down, come see the space. We're always willing to help. All of our artists are so gracious and humble and willing to share what we've learned.
Awesome. Well, that's great. And I'll post links to your site, and I'll include a link to that short film as well, because I think that's really helpful to give people more background on kind of what's going on here. But yeah.
In closing, I'd like to say thanks to the Meow Wolf team for really understanding the unique program that we have and sending us Jody McNicholas to make the film. She's an extraordinarily gifted filmmaker.
Yeah, it's so cool to have your work and community reflected back to you through the eyes of a gifted creator themselves. That's really cool. Yeah. Cool. You. Well, thank you. That's all for this week. Join me next week for an interview with a professional hand balancer from Norway, Ulrik Fossum. Ulrik's dedication to his unusual craft, as well as his wit and insights, are definitely worth tuning in for. Until next week, this is Damian Taggart wishing you a week filled with love and opportunity.